and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. This is the Saturday edition. I'm Cindy Yu. So this week, Toby Young writes in the magazine about Boris Derangement Syndrome, a condition where his opponents are so blinded by their dislike for him that they lose sight of who he really is. Isabel Hardman spoke to Toby Young and New Statesman's political editor Stephen Bush in the Spectator podcast earlier this week. If you enjoy this discussion, the Spectator podcast is a weekly magazine discussion of a few articles from the magazine with the writers behind them. Isabel Hardman presents together with Lara Prendergast, so do give it a listen. It's on Spectator Radio, or just search for it on your iTunes store. Here's Isabel.
So Stephen, Toby accuses a number of people on the left of suffering from Boris Derangement Syndrome. Have you recognised that in your contacts?
Yeah, I think it definitely does exist, and not just, I would say, on my contacts on the left. I mean, during his leadership campaign, Rory Stewart said that he did not think Boris Johnson could be trusted with the nuclear codes. Two problems with that. The first, of course, is that is not how our deterrent works. The second is, I think, even as I say this, someone who does not think he acquitted himself at all well as foreign secretary, the charge of what he actually did wrong is what he failed to do, not that he was someone who would somehow blunder into nuclear fire through activity. And I think that is definitely something that people have. I think the open question, of course, is Boris Derangement Syndrome something which afflicts a large constituency in the country, right? Is it like Blair Derangement Syndrome in 1997, pastime of a couple of eccentric people on the right? Or is it like Blair Derangement Syndrome after 2004, when it was very much not a pastime of a minority of a country, but an increasingly popular opinion? And I think the danger for the Conservative Party is that actually that syndrome is quite widespread nowadays.
Toby, what do you think it is that particularly sparks this derangement syndrome in MPs and Boris Johnson's opponents? I was talking to one MP who was really venting about this MP was from a humbler background, shall we say, than Boris Johnson, and they felt that they wouldn't be able to get away with the sort of things that Boris does just because he's posh, was their argument. And that sort of chip on the shoulder seems to really set a lot of people off. Do you think it's that, or do you think it's something else?
I think it's a combination of things. I think it's partly a sort of resentful jealousy that journalists have for another journalist who just refuses to stay in his lane, but has kind of ventured forth into politics and has done pretty well and looks like is going to go all the way. So I think there's a sort of general resentment about the fact that he ceased to be a spectator and entered the arena.
Is it a resentment or a suspicion?
Probably a combination of the two. I think there's, as you say, there is this kind of class hostility. He can kind of bring out the chippiness, you know, almost in people you would otherwise think were quite posh. I mean, a good example is Zoe Williams in The Guardian in 2008 wrote a kind of vituperative column saying, amongst other things, once you've been to public school, then you are from postcode posh. And the odd thing about that is that Zoe herself went to Godolphin and Latimer, which is a £21,000 a year London day school that may have been a bit cheaper back then. So I think that's an element of it. I also think there's a kind of general puritanical dislike of his kind of cavalier, slightly amoral attitude. This business about him getting away with things that other people can't get away with. I think there's a sort of sense that we don't live in a just universe. If someone who commits all these mistakes and sins in the way that Boris has sinned is somehow unscathed by it.
Is it not also that he's a bit of a wind-up merchant? I mean, he does use language that if you sat back and thought about how people might react, you'd probably get the sense that they were going to be pretty angry about, for instance, saying that Muslim women wearing burqas looked like letterboxes and bank robbers, talking about people with watermelon smiles and so often. I mean, that's not somebody who wants to mollify, is it? So he is sort of seeking a bit of derangement in the reaction to him.
Clearly, one of the explanations for the prevalence of Boris Derangement Syndrome is that there's plenty of material to work with.
And that's his fault, isn't it? Because he wrote it.
But I'm not sure that necessarily hurts him, though. He's constantly being hit by offence archaeologists who've dug up various supposedly offensive things he said over his 35-year career as a journalist. I mean, you saw that on Channel 4 News last week when they interviewed the two lesbians that were beaten up on the London bus and asked them whether they thought Boris was fit to run the country. But before that, carefully explained to them that Boris was a, quote, homophobe and misogynist. And I think there is this kind of feeling on the part of the metropolitan elite, particularly in Romania, that he is not a pound shop Trump, but kind of German street Trump, that we are in the midst of a culture war and Boris is on the wrong side. But the irony is that on all the big culture war issues, gay rights, abortion, immigration, Boris is actually on the same side as the metropolitan elite. So that doesn't really play. And I think the fact that that doesn't play and doesn't really land helps Boris because it means that they're not actually landing blows where they might be.
Stephen, do you think that actually this is going to help or hinder Boris's premiership if he does indeed become prime minister? Because it may well be that people are so deranged by him that he's able to continue to get away with a lot more than he otherwise would because they're so busy getting worked up rather than noticing what he's actually doing.
And I think one of the reasons why I think it will be quite a short premiership, right, is ultimately we shouldn't be, because I don't actually think that the off-colour language is the problem, right? The off-colour language is something which was known about him when he won in 2012, a year when Labour candidates were being victorious all over the country, and he managed to survive in 2012. But that was because he was seen as someone who told it like it was, and who people, including lots of people in London who have now memory hold that they felt this way, quite liked him. The issue is Brexit, right? That is the big problem for both political parties, and it has polarised the electorate, and it makes it very hard for them to win majorities. And the Conservative Party is now almost certainly going to have, as its candidate in an election that it will almost certainly have to have before the end of this year, a man who is the reverse of catnip for half of the electorate. That probably simplifies Labour's task in terms of how it holds on to its Remainers, and it severely complicates the Conservative path to a majority, because we saw in 2017 that the problem that we now have as a country is not enough people are willing to vote on Remain Leave lines, or too many people are willing to vote on Remain Leave lines. And I think his big problem is not, you know, that he irritates a couple of people, but that a large chunk of Remainers, including Remainers who voted for him, now loathe him as a result.
And what about the Conservative Party? It obviously has now backed Boris to the hilt to get into the final two, its MPs have. But there are a lot of MPs who are still very angrily anyone but Boris. Is it going to be more riven by splits if he becomes Prime Minister?
Well, there was a bit of speculation about who the two Conservative MPs were that spoilt their ballot papers in the penultimate ballot, and the suspicion is that they're people who couldn't bring themselves to vote for any of the candidates and won't serve under Boris. And there's some speculation that Rory Stewart, he sort of already said, well, he sort of flip-flopped on it, but he sort of said that he wouldn't be in a Boris cabinet. It's hard to know whether there would be any defections in the event of Boris becoming leader. People have said they would in the past, but, you know, the Conservative Party tends to be quite loyal. And to Stephen's point, I think that you're sort of assuming that there will be a general election before we've exited. I don't think that's a foregone conclusion. I don't think he's likely to get many concessions, if any, out of Europe. But I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that if he does try and take us out without a deal, that he would lose a confidence vote. I don't think it's particularly attractive for other parties, even some of the Change UK independents, to have a general election right now before this issue's been resolved. So I think it's perfectly possible that we won't have a general election until we've left, in which case all these other issues come into play.
Does Boris derangement syndrome possibly apply to the EU as well, Stephen?
No, although there are lots of European diplomats who dislike Boris Johnson, who blame him for, you know, who believe that the story of the referendum was that he lied and as a result Brexit happened, the more important an almost unique problem with these negotiations, right, is that for obvious reasons, the EU needs to prove that you cannot get a better deal outside. And the Brexit project obviously relies on you being able to get a better deal outside. Now, almost all trade negotiations are about mutually shared goals. Now, the weird thing is this is a trade negotiation in which there is, yes, the mutually shared goal of a trade negotiation, but in which one side needs to definitively prove it has won and the other side needs to prove it has definitively won. And it is essentially impossible, I think, to reconcile those two strategic asks, regardless of who the individual people on either side of the EU-UK negotiating teams are.
Finally, Toby, what do you expect the membership round of this Conservative leadership contest to look like?
Well, all the polling of Conservative members suggests that Boris will win by a pretty wide margin, whoever he's up against. But, you know, things can go wrong. The favourite often doesn't win, as many people have said. I think if it is Michael Gove, I think Michael Gove will put up a better fist of opposing Boris than lots of people expect. I don't expect the kind of blue-on-blue psychodrama that many people are fearful of, if that does end up being the final two. I think it'll be a proper, quite grown-up debate. Maybe not on the BBC again, because of the bruising experience they had during the BBC debate earlier this week. But I think there will be a proper debate, and I think, you know, Boris, I think, has said different things to different people about exactly what his Brexit plan is going to be and what the circumstances are in which he'd accept a deal and so forth. So he's got these different constituencies with different expectations. And if Michael can kind of play on that, I think that could damage Boris a little bit. So I don't think it's an absolute foregone conclusion, but I do think it's overwhelmingly likely that Boris
Stephen.
Will win.
Stephen.
Yeah, I think it's exactly like that. It feels a bit like, you know, a football cup final in which, you know, you have a good team versus, say, Spurs. Now, obviously, they're in the final. They've got a chance. Probably not a very good chance, but certainly a chance. And I think the fact that it will not be as easy for Boris Johnson, if it is Michael Gove, to portray it as Remain v Leave makes it harder for him. However, for exactly that reason, I would be astonished, even though I don't believe there has been tactical voting thus far, if Boris Johnson's team don't decide to have at least some tactical voting for this final round.
Thank you, Toby and Stephen.